Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. You can watch today's program later today or tomorrow over Facebook. Today, we're going to talk about the latest things in helping us live a longer and healthier life. And as always, you will see these come from respected and reputable institutions published in peer-reviewed journals, but things that are natural, non-toxic. Why do I take the time to find these studies and then to give you the specifics from where they're done? Because for decades, medical doctors, holistic nurses and dentists, nutritionists and dietitians, anyone who was advocating for a healthier, more natural life was told, well, it's only what the orthodox medical community shares that is legitimate. Everything else is not science-based. To the contrary, those of us who advocate good science, I'm a scientist, I'm a PhD in human nutrition and public health science, and a registered dietitian, and a clinical nutritionist, and a researcher, and a journalist, all legitimate. And yet all the information I advocate comes from the best natural and non-toxic methods of helping. That's why I do that. And we're having new listeners all the time to this program. And I also want to thank all of our stations for syndicating this program and sharing it with your audience. It's greatly appreciated. Let's begin with inflammation. Why? Because inflammation drives Alzheimer's. Now, I've been advocating this for a long time. In fact, one of the ways that I help people who have dementia and Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis, and other brain and neurological disorders is I get them to go to a highly alkaline state, meaning starting the day with apple cider vinegar, about a tablespoon, lemon juice, also a tablespoon, some ginger. You can put it all together, by the way. You can put it all together and put it in a smoothie if this taste is too strong. A little manuka honey, some lemon juice or lime juice, ginger juice, and then dilute that with green apple juice. That is a terrific way before you exercise, before you do anything else to start your day. You're taking the body from an acidic state, and that's where your pain comes from, the pain in your muscles and your joints, but it's also where you get a lot of your inflammation. So if you understand that inflammation is caused by what we eat and breathe and drink and just normal living, oxidative stress creates free radicals. And free radicals by the hundreds of billions a day, their lifespan is very short, just seconds. But in that seconds, those free radicals are able to damage or alter every gene in your body about 10,000 times per gene per day. Therefore, anything that you do that can lessen inflammation will lessen the damage to the DNA, will lessen the type of diseases you're susceptible to, and will speed up the healing process. Therefore, quite simply, you'll live a longer life, a healthier life, be less susceptible or not as susceptible at all to cancers and heart disease, dementia, and Alzheimer's. And when I, 10 years ago, I did a study that lasted 16 months, meeting with our members who had Alzheimer's and myasthenia gravis and multiple sclerosis and other conditions, met with them on a weekly basis for a year and a half. And these were advanced cases. Very first thing was an anti-inflammatory diet, which is a plant-based diet with lots of juices. And the green juices are particularly very healing with juicing, let's say, celery and cucumber, green apple and parsley, arugula and watercress, kale. All those go into a juice. Now, separately, you can also turn off inflammation and help alkalize with red juices, watermelon, raspberry, cherry, and those are all good. Red plums, papaya, red in red flesh, or orange flesh inside, excellent for you. The greens cleanse and detoxify, the reds heal and reverse aging. So now instead of having 10,000 gene alterations per cell per day, you might have 2,000 or 1,000 or less. And that's why some people look better, because they've made different choices. Now, this study is from the German Center for Neurodegenerative Diseases, and it was published in a peer-reviewed journal, Nature. In fact, probably the most respected scientific journal in the world is Nature. And according to this study, the German Center for Neurodegenerative Disease, quote, in the University of Bonn, they found inflammatory mechanisms caused by the brain's immune system drive progression of Alzheimer's disease. These findings, which rely upon a series of laboratory experiments, provide new insights into pathogenic mechanisms that are believed to hold potential for tackling Alzheimer's before symptoms manifest. The researchers envision that one day this may lead to new treatments. Well, Alzheimer's is a devastating neurodegenerative disease, and it's marked by these amyloid plaques, these amyloid, what are called amyloid beta, or A-beta plaques. These are proteins, and they accumulate in the brain and appear to harm the neurons. And in recent years, studies have revealed that deposits of the amyloid plaques, just known as plaques, trigger inflammatory mechanisms of the brain's innate immune system. So what I just told you can turn off inflammation. Now, that's just with your diet. Juices, stay away from sugar, high fructose corn syrup, carbonated beverages like the colas, stay away from the fried meats and the french fries, the pizzas, the hot dogs, the hamburgers. The majority of the American diet is pro-inflammatory. Hence, creates obesity. Obesity creates inflammation. Inflammation contributes to heart disease, cancer, diabetes, all of these because of what we eat and what we drink. Coffee is very bad also. Green tea is very good. So just be very conscious of what you're consuming, and you can lessen your likelihood of Alzheimer's. But also, if you have heart disease, if you have Alzheimer's, this very same diet, along with proper supplementation, can help reverse it. And we've done it. It's not theoretical. It's not anecdotal. We've done it in a good quality, highly scientifically based lifestyle and behavior modification support group, a clinical study, non-medical, non-invasive, but monitored and overseen by board-certified neurologists. So if we did this nationally, in 1 year, if the children that, who have parents who are suffering from these neurodegenerative conditions follow this program, you would see an enormous improvement in the cognition, the energy, the awareness, the memory of people suffering from dementia. You shouldn't skip adding vinegar to your next salad. This is from Dr. Michael Greger. I'll quote it. A famous study from Harvard University published back in 1999 found that women who used oil and vinegar salad dressing about every day went on to have fewer than half the fatal heart attacks compared to women who had never used it at all. That's less than half the risk of the number one killer for women. That means 50% of all women would not be having heart attacks if they had olive oil and apple cider vinegar as a salad dressing or rice vinegar. Researchers found that it was the omega-3 fatty acids in the oil that explained the benefit. I know what you're thinking. Those who use salad dressing every day probably also eat salad every day. So perhaps it was the salad that was so beneficial. But no, they were able to adjust for vegetable intake, so it didn't appear to be the salad. Why, though, does oil get the credit and not the vinegar? Well, what about creamy salad dressings. They also are made from the omega-3 oils like canola oil. In fact, even more so than oil and vinegar dressing. So if it's the oil and not the vinegar, then creamy dressings would be protective, right? But they're not. They found no significant decrease in fatal heart attack rates or in the non-fatal heart attack rates, for that matter. Now it could be that the eggs or the butterfat in these dressings counteracted the benefits of the omega-3 fatty acids, or perhaps the vinegar is actually playing a role. But how? Vinegar enhances arterial function by allowing our arteries to better dilate naturally by boosting the activity of the enzyme in our body that synthesizes nitric oxide, the open sesame signal to our arteries that improves blood flow. And by the way, the best single thing you can do to improve blood flow, and especially men who are suffering from erectile dysfunction because you're not getting adequate blood into the reproductive region, beet juice. Drinking a 6-ounce glass of beet juice really enhances nitric oxide flow in the body, relaxing the blood vessels, allowing greater blood flow. But also, as an athlete, as a competitive athlete, as someone who's competed in over 650 races and has won the majority of those, or been a winner, I can tell you that once I started using beet juice, I found that I was not, with age, I was not losing my performance capacity. So for all the athletes in this audience, and there are a lot of you, have that glass of beet juice before you go out for your morning walk or bike ride or to the gym or to the track. It'll enhance your athletic performance. So now let's recap. Vinegar enhances arterial function by allowing our arteries to better dilate, open up. And that's important. And acetate is cleared out of your blood within half an hour of consuming a salad with a tablespoon of vinegar in it. This apparently isn't enough time to boost the AMPK enzyme, but within just 10 minutes, those kind of acetate levels can boost the activity of the nitric oxide synthesizing enzyme within human umbilical cord blood vessel cells in a petri dish. So, but what about in people? Let's get real. What happens in a petri dish doesn't mean it's going to happen in our bodies. Researchers also measured the dilation of arteries in the arms of women after they had 1 tablespoon of rice vinegar. 1 tablespoon of brown rice vinegar, and 1 tablespoon of rice vinegar that's made from purple rice. All the vinegars appeared to help, but it was the black and the purple rice that mostly clearly pulled away from the pack. Black rice contains the same kind of anthocyanin pigments that make some fruits and vegetables blue and purple, and may have independent benefits. For example, if you give someone a big blueberry smoothie containing the amount of anthocyanidins in 1.5 cups of wild blueberries, you get a nice spike in arterial function that lasts almost 3 hours. And that's why I keep advocating for people in this audience have at least 1 cup, that's about a pint, of wild blueberries a day. Now, you can buy wild blueberries frozen, put them in your refrigerator, and overnight they thaw out. I use at least a bowl of wild blueberries a day. And I add a bowl of cherries and a bowl of pomegranates every single day, which is one of the reasons that my heart, and I get a cardiovascular maximum stress test every year, is that of a 25-year-old, because I'm healing the arterial wall as you could and should, the epithelium, the lining of the wall, so it's not cracked and scarred and with lesions that can break off and create clots and cause you a heart attack. So it's not expensive, and it's one of the least expensive ways to stay healthy. Have bowls of berries. So thus, the highest maximum forearm blood flow in the rice vinegar group might be attributed to an additional or synergistic effect of the anthocyanins with the acetate, meaning the color, purple color. So, but what does it mean if you're using balsamic vinegar, which is made from red wine? It may have similar effect, as it's been shown to have remarkably higher free radical scavenging activity than rice vinegar. Could it be enough to counter the artery-constricting effects of a high-fat meal? We've known for many years, over 20 years, that eating a single high-fat meal, there's your sausage, or there's your, let's say, your waffles with butter, or a glass of milk with bacon and eggs, or having a milkshake and a hamburger, very common, that you're putting a lot of fat in your blood. And that fat is causing an aggregation, coming together, a clumping of red blood cells, and that can create a clot. And it's the blood clot that ends up causing strokes and heart attack. So they did the study and found out that extra virgin olive oil, which is not refined, is very beneficial for your arteries. And vinegars are good for your arteries. Nuts are good for your arteries. They actually improve, walnuts in particular, improve arterial function. And so then you use the apple cider vinegar or the rice vinegar or the black vinegar. So those are the latest things to put on your salad, and it could help you. Very important. Now, here's something interesting. This is from the U.S. National Center for Health Statistics, and it was just released today, this morning. And it talks about how the U.S. life expectancy is dropping as opiate deaths surge. Quote, the opiate epidemic continues to chip away at the average American lifespan. Life expectancy declined in the United States for the second year in a row in 2016, driven downward by fatal drug overdoses in young and middle-aged adults, according to the National U.S. Center for Health Statistics. It said, quote, that in 2 years, they've had a remarkable decrease in life expectancy. Now, that's for people taking the drugs. Life expectancy is actually increasing for those people who follow the advice on this program, and many of you do. So remember, they get an average lifespan by taking people who die young from, let's say, drugs like opiates, 60,000 deaths this year, and people who don't take any drugs, who don't smoke, who don't drink, who exercise, who have a healthy plant-based diet, who do mindful meditation, and who deal with stress appropriately and have good belief systems. And those people are living to be 100, and these people are dying at 50. So then you take a medium and you're at, you know, 75. So that's what it means. So we're actually living longer because we're making healthier choices. And we're living shorter because we're making unhealthy choices. That's how powerful it is. And finally, before we take our break, and then I'm going to come back and talk about issues that I think are important, like sustainability. And we should be returning to small farming and supporting organic small farms, get away from these mono farms. Because a lot of Americans, a lot of my generation, baby boomers, thought it would be really cool to step out of corporate America or our little cubicle existences and go to work on our own farms. But unfortunately, instead of doing organic, sustainable small farms, 10 acres, 5 acres, they went out and bought big old acre farms in Indiana and Illinois and Kansas, and then started using regular farming techniques, which were wrong. Those are antiquated, destructive. Now they're going bankrupt. So I'll talk about that after the break. Here's the latest. This is from Natural Health. Statin drugs expose 10 dangers of cholesterol-lowering drugs they don't want you to know. And then it goes on to talk about how many people are using statins. It's a $29 billion a year industry in statins. And, quote, most conventionally trained physicians believe that cholesterol is a primary risk factor for heart disease. The American Heart Association insists that there are two kinds of heart cholesterol, good and bad, the LDL being the bad, the HDL being the good. And the American Heart Association, the U.S. Center for Disease Control, the CDC, and the American College of Cardiologists all stand squarely behind statin use. But they're all wrong. Too little cholesterol, some experts maintain, can be just as harmful as too much. So they took a look at 68,000 deaths conducted by the Division of Epidemiology at the University of Minnesota, and they revealed, listen carefully, quote, that low cholesterol predicted an increased risk of dying from gastrointestinal and respiratory disease. And here are the diseases you can get from taking statins. Mood changes and concentration problems, increased risk of diabetes, higher cancer rates, liver damage, reduced mitochondrial at your energy factories after exercise, decreased levels of important disease-fighting nutrients, and decreased levels of natural antioxidants like coenzyme Q10, overeating, weight gain, nerve and muscle damage, increased dangerous arterial plaque, all from taking your statins. So before you take a statin, I suggest you speak with a holistic cardiologist and see natural and non-toxic ways of helping your heart. Or read Dr. Dean Ornish's classic milestone book on reversing heart disease naturally. I actually filmed him at that time doing that study. Now, this is from Kirk Cobb. I thought you'd find this of interest. I'm only going to do part of this. The rest I posted on my website. This is called, Do We Have the Wrong Model of Human Nature? Think carefully on what he says. I wished our phone system's coming back in Tuesday, so you have a chance to call in on TalkBack. Are we wrong to believe that competitiveness must and always will be the central animating principle of human action? Media studies scholar Michael Carlberg thinks so. In fact, he believes that another animating principle, mutualism, is both central to human interactions and necessary to aid human society in meeting the myriad challenges it faces regarding climate change and inequality and governance, education. And then it goes on to talk about how I saw Carlberg speak recently at a private gathering in Washington, D.C. He is measured in his tone, clear in his delivery, and compelling in his logic. He poses the following question. If nearly all of our institutions are premised on competition, commerce, politics, education, recreation, and many others, is it any wonder that our competitive instincts are honed and expanded while our cooperative ones atrophy? Carlberg is not naive enough to believe that all this can be changed overnight, but he does make a convincing case that competitiveness is as much a problem emanating from social institutions that inculcate and incentivize competition as it is as a problem of human nature. The way forward, he asserts, is to build new institutions that emphasize cooperation. It's a sizable task, but one which has already begun, as he explains at the end of a TED Talk. And however utopian this goal may seem, Carlberg reminds us that the current culture of contest, as he styles it, has given us the existential threat of climate change, spawned by endless economic growth and consumption. In fact, the culture of contest is creating a series of social and ecological challenges so profound that unless we change that culture, we may drive ourselves towards extinction. Well, now think of that for a moment. Let's just analyze what has been written here. Virtually everything that we are taught is that we are measured by what we achieve. And it is our determinist, our manifest destiny. The harder you work, the smarter you are, the more manipulative you are, the better taskmaster you are, you will achieve a certain prominence. And that immediately causes everyone else to defer to you. But we don't question what this could be doing to those who believe that it is not through cooperation that we grow and heal and revitalize or protect, but it's rather through unique competition. It's much like Al Gore. He is a very convincing and articulate speaker about global warming, and on many of his facts, he's absolutely correct. And on his presentations, they are formidable. Unless you are a very aware and astute environmentalist, in which case you realize that he is only promoting that solar and a specific company he has a lot of money in, and his hedge fund, billions, I think 7 to 9 billion the last time I checked. And therefore, one single piece, a legitimate piece, but only one piece of a big puzzle that could help us. You don't hear him advocating or showing you wave power that would be the wonderful energy for most of the world, because most of the world is continents are connected by water, and that water is waving. And as a result, that's a perpetual source of energy, non-polluting energy. Or geothermal, like Iceland. You go to Iceland, many of their roads have no snow on them or ice. Sidewalks are the same because they're heated from underneath with geothermal, volcanic streams of heat, steam. We have those in the United States. We have hundreds of large geothermal hotspots in the United States, not just Yellowstone National Park. We have no money, not a penny invested in geothermal energy. There's a new type of wind power that is bladeless, that does not impact killing birds or making noises or is an environmental blight. He's not promoting that. He is promoting what he benefits from. He's not promoting that we prevent global warming by going to a plant-based diet. That would be the largest single reduction in carbon dioxide and methane gas, and therefore slowing down much of global warming and keeping it below 2.0 degrees Celsius increase. And yet he's not a vegan. And his family ran a cattle farm down in the South, Tennessee or Kentucky, one of wherever he's located. So it's how complete we see a problem. And if we see it as competing with other energies instead of cooperating with other energies, using them all, competing with other environmental groups to get the money instead of cooperating with other farmers instead of competing. An interesting construct from both South America and from India, but I'll use India. Before the 1950s, Indians were very poor. They'd just come through hundreds of years of Indian rule, where the Rajas and the mercantiles made fortunes, but the average peasant was very poor, destitute frequently, and intentionally malnourished and starved. In Bengal, anywhere from 4 to 6 million Bengalis died of starvation, due specifically to one person, Winston Churchill. And he had the authority and he exercised it to take crops that were grown in the most fertile area of India and ship them so they could be stored by profiteers in the cities, where people had to pay 300 or 400 percent higher than normal, or shipped out of India to the United Kingdom to be used by people who were not starving, did not need it. That was an intentional crime. That was a crime against humanity. Yet he is not known for that. He's known for ending World War II by helping save Britain at the beginning of it, 1940, Dunkirk, where 300,000 to 400,000 British and French soldiers had been trying to get off that shore and get over to Great Britain because the Germans had overtaken Belgium and France and Denmark and other countries and Poland, and now they were headed towards Great Britain. and the entire British Army was there. And it was interesting because this is just as an aside historically, but Neville Chamberlain was the prime minister, and he is the one who believed that Hitler and I think it was Ribbentrop wanted peace, and they would not hurt Great Britain, and they were simply taking back, annexing in effect, countries that at one time, before the Versailles Treaty, had been a part of the Germany, the larger German Empire. But they weren't going to touch Great Britain, and so Neville Chamberlain was willing to go through an appeasement, and as a result, Great Britain did not have a chance to arm themselves and to start preparing for what would ultimately be the betrayal, and because Hitler had every intention of taking over everything, including destroying Great Britain. And there they were, right days, hours before Great Britain was going to destroy the British Army in its entirety and easily would have destroyed any of the Royal Air Force. And then they would destroy Great Britain until it had to surrender, and then it would just become a colony of Germany. Most people are not aware of this, that when Winston Churchill was asked to allow a high member of the British government and Neville Chamberlain, who had just lost a vote of confidence, and Winston Churchill had just been appointed to take his place, that they wanted to go and have Mussolini negotiate a treaty with Great Britain. And as long as Germany promised not to invade and to allow Great Britain, United Kingdom, to remain a sovereign state, that would have meant that there would have been a treaty. That meant that the 300,000 to 400,000 soldiers trapped at the shores and no place to go, even though it was only like a 29-mile channel to get across, they would have been saved instead of completely destroyed. And Churchill, in one of the most remarkable decisions in military history, said no. He said, this is a man, Adolf Hitler, that has lied. He cannot be trusted. And I say no. And they say, he's going to destroy 300,000 to 400,000 people. 300,000 of those were British Army. And then he's going to come into our country and destroy us. You've got to allow us. And he said no. And the House was ready to get rid of him. In fact, the King of England at that time had met with Churchill, didn't like Churchill. Nobody liked Churchill. He was not a likable person. He was a sociopath. He was a narcissist. He was brilliant. He had one of the greatest knowledge of history of anyone in Great Britain. He was an orator. He was articulate. He was funny. He was capable of having conversations that would last 6 hours. But he, on the other side of that, he was malicious. He was misogynist. He would put people down in public. He was impatient. He bore no fools. He believed that he was the only one who had an honest answer to anything. You could not convince him otherwise. He was not changing his mind about anything. He was reticent. He was a drunkard. He was a massive alcoholic. He started his day with alcohol, and he would drink 10 to 15 glasses of alcohol a day. He was drunk frequently. Franklin Roosevelt, when he met Churchill, wrote a memo about this guy's a drunken louse. I mean, he's a drunkard. And he was. He was drunk frequently. And he would stay up late at night. He couldn't sleep. And he ate garbage. He was unhealthy. He would frequently go half a day in bed, so he expected everyone to come in. And he would dictate his letters to his secretary, who he was rude to. He'd call people every name in the book. And he was estranged from his own children. He wasn't a good parent. He wasn't a good husband. He was a real loathsome person. But in this one moment, one singular moment, he said no. And everyone was against him, including at that point the king. And the king's very close and longtime friend came to him and said, "You got to get rid of him." And he was going to. And the king was suggested he go to Canada with the royal family, and then Churchill argued with him, "Well, how's that going to look if you leave? Well, what's that saying to everyone else in Great Britain?" So they made arrangements for them to be at other places and to at least show a presence of support. And that was Churchill that prevented the king from leaving. But then Churchill did something that no one, not his entire war cabinet, agreed with. The entire war cabinet was against him. He was the only one supporting this. They said that sign the treaty, you know, negotiate with the Germans, and in effect surrender. So just so we're clear on this, the entire war cabinet of Great Britain suggested surrendering to Germany and allowing Mussolini, the dictator, the fascist, to negotiate the surrender in such a way that it would allow some saving of face and some sovereignty. And that is exactly what Churchill said no to. But because he was still prime minister, they hadn't fired him yet. The king had not called him to the palace to get him to resign. He called the one of the, I think it was admiral of the Navy, and he said, "How many ships do we have?" Well, they couldn't put ships up because every ship that went out and to try to rescue was being destroyed and sunk by the German Luftwaffe under Goering. So instead, Churchill did something that was brilliant. He put the word out, contact every person that owns a boat longer than 30 feet that can go over and pick up our troops and bring them back. In a period of hours, over 900 boats started this journey, going across the canal, the English canal, and picking up at Dunkirk, small community, and picking up the sailor, putting up the soldiers and bringing them back. And you know that they saved over 250,000? And it shook up Hitler because Hitler thought he had it all and he didn't know how to handle the defiance. And then once those boats were going over there, he went into Parliament and he said, "We will never surrender. We will fight them." What do you say? Something, we'll fight them in the air. We'll fight them in the sea. We'll fight them on land. And it shifted the entire mindset of the British people, who then supported him. Now, think of why that's important, because had Great Britain, United Kingdom, had they surrendered to Germany at Dunkirk in those days, we're not talking about months or weeks, days, then there would have been no Allied landing. There would have been no building up of troops, of other Allied troops. There would have been no armies in exile like Charles de Gaulle and others going to Great Britain and living. That means that Hitler would have won the Second World War. America would still be America. They wouldn't have invaded it, but all of Europe would have been under the control of Germany. And it means also that Germany probably would have succeeded in its campaign against the Russians because it wouldn't have had a divided front. So a man who did so many reprehensible and racist and inhuman things, true, also saved the world from Germany, also true. But he was such an irascible person that at the end of the war, Labor voted him out because he was also anti-unionist. So, I don't know, just a little sidetrack. Anyhow, So here's another thing to think about. This is from the New Internationalist, from Pat Mooney and Naomi Bassi, and it says, industrial agriculture isn't the efficient beast it's made out to be. Peasant farming, not industrial food production, is the way to feed the world. Time is running out if the world is going to slash greenhouse gas emissions keep enough to keep it below the 1.5 temperature rise. Well, forget 1.5. We're well going to go way past that, even right now, even in the next immediate future. Two conferences this autumn tackled different ends of the problem. In splendid isolation from each other, the UN Committee on World Food Security held its annual meeting in Rome in mid-October, alarmed that the number of hungry people on the planet has suddenly climbed to 40 million in the past year. That's 40 million. There's already 1 billion. So they're adding 40 million just last year on top of 1 billion. Much of it due to the direct and indirect effects of climate change, and fearful that an unpredictable climate will cut global food production still even more sharply in the decades ahead. Meanwhile, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, met in Bonn, and high on its agenda was the need to cut agriculture's greenhouse gas emissions, which experts say account for anywhere from one-third to more than one-half of global warming. So what for Rome delegates is a problem of food security is for Bonn delegates a problem of climate security. And then it goes on to talk about why we should be getting back to peasant farming. Now, this relates to something I discussed last week, and that is with 1 million women farmers, and a lot of them, if not most of them, in Arizona, and farmers going bankrupt and closing down because of how hard it is, especially in Missouri. An article today about how many farms are just closing up. They're in debt. They can't pay their mortgages. There's not enough money in the crops they're producing. It's a simple problem. Put those 1 million women, farmers who own farms or running farms, in doing sustainable agriculture, doing hydroponics, and getting the hell out of Arizona. Nobody should be farming anything, even though we farm a lot of cotton there. We shouldn't be farming in Arizona because it's not hospitable. You're running out of water. The soil is too hot. You have seeds dying because they're overheating. So move from Arizona, move from Nevada, move from New Mexico, move from Illinois or Indiana, move from Kansas, move from California, move from Texas. If you want to farm, farm in states like Pennsylvania, West Virginia, New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont, Wisconsin, Michigan. There you have water. You have good soil. And for winter, you can do hydroponics. For summer, you can do outdoor. And there's raised bed gardens. There's hydroponic gardens, the French intensive gardening. There's a dozen different ways that you can garden, and you can grow hundreds of crops, not a single crop. That's the problem now. These people are going broke because they're using non-organic methods. Their soil's dried out. They are having poor times with soybeans or corn or wheat, the three major crops grown in the United States, where a local community could be buying everything you grow. In fact, where I live, there are 13 farmers markets visited by thousands of people per Saturday. You could have more food that you're growing than you could possibly serve to the people because there's such a demand. The demand is far greater than the supply at this moment and growing. But you have to diversify. You have to get into understanding how to do small scale, not these 100, 200, 500, where you have to have big machinery and you have to have pesticides and you have to have herbicides and you have to have nitrogen fertilizers. That's history. It's over. Get out of that. No matter how long your family has owned the farm, get over that. All right? You got to decommission the mind from believing that somehow you are the final, you know, the generation that's going to carry on the family tradition. The family tradition worked at one time, then it didn't work, and it's never going to work again. you're in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong idea, and you're the wrong person with the wrong support system. So what possibly could go wrong? The question is, nothing's going to go right. So move to those communities, and therefore you can make it work. Let me give you an example. I'll give you a pure, easy example. I was going to do this myself this year. I still may. Go upstate New York. Go up to Goshen, or go up to the Finger Lakes, or go to where a lot of apples are grown, up around New Paltz. Go into Ulster County. You can find orchards that are older orchards. They're not expensive. You could buy an orchard. Now, it's not that you're going to use the orchard per se, but now you've got something that's already zoned for farming, that is set up for farming, that has drive-in storage lockers, coal lockers for cold storage, because apples, you can only sell so much when you harvest them. Most of them sold over the next year, and as long as apples are kept in cool storage, they can last for a long time. But you can grow in that same area. You can grow grapes because of rolling terrain, lots of sunlight. You're not going to have your plants rot because of flat terrain or clay down in Texas or Alabama, where you got clay, and Georgia, where you got clay. And when it rains, and a lot of rain, there's no place for the rain to go. The soil is not loamless, and so as a result, it stays there, and the clay caps keep the water up, and then it rots the root system, massive rot. Well, when you have nice drainage, and you have good sunlight, and you have good temperatures, you can grow grapes, and you can grow other crops, and then you could put a hydroponic right in the middle of that, so what's growing in season is great, and what's growing in the winter is completely separate. Microgreens, sprouts. You can grow 40 different types of microgreens, 30 different types of sprouts. And then you can grow lettuce, cucumbers, and tomatoes in 20 days, 30 days. And new methods are increasing this. And then you have local markets that can take that. You don't have to ship a single crop off across the United States and increase the carbon footprint and the cost of that. Local diversified farming is the future. And you can then work cooperatively. You can get other people whose farms did not fare well and get them to come and work on this farm and cooperate with a new paradigm. I see cooperation. I see we as the future, not me. We got to get out of that whole mindset that, well, I own it, it's mine. No. We're only caretakers of anything that we possess. Everything that we own, the house we live in, the apartment we live in, the condo we live in, the condo on a golf course that we live in, someone else, when we pass, will take that over. So we're only stewards. We're only, if we get the humility to accept where we stand in the larger scheme of life, then the best thing we can do is cooperate so that we can sustain. Because those who are out there wildcatters, doing everything on their own, they're spending a lot of time and energy and work. It would be a lot easier if you worked with other people and shared in the benefit of that, shared in the reduced stress of that, shared in the camaraderie of that, shared in the friendship of that, share in the companionship of that, share in an ecological village of that. And I'm not talking about cults, and I'm not talking about co-ops, not talking about the nonsense 1970s. I'm talking about maintaining autonomy and individuality and creativity, but sharing so many other things with others. The benefits and rewards you can share. That's what I see as the future. Now, here is Peter Schiff giving you some insights on where he believes the economy is going, and the people who care about sustainability will stop buying property right now, houses, and because we're going to have a crash, and we're once again having an increase of over 40% in the average retail value, the homeowner's value, and then we're borrowing against that. Like, once again, it's our equity. It's not your equity. When you borrow, you're now in debt. You have their cash. They have your property. You're going to spend the cash on something that will not make you more, and they're going to take your property if you can't pay for it. Now you're going to be paying interest. So you're going to pay far more back to them than what you borrowed. And you've already blown it. You've spent it. So stop buying, and if you have debt, get out of it, because we're about to hit some bad times. Here's Peter Schiff.
My pleasure, Greg. Always good to be with you.
Well, in the article, which, you know, I was surprised. I read the article. I thought, well, they're going to say, well, he was right in 07 about the coming market crash. But, you know, he's, you know, some terrible, you know, black mark against you or something, that they would paint you some, you know, crazy person, which, of course, you're not. And they didn't do that in here. They actually took you serious and gave you credit for predicting a market crash. But what you brought out, and that none of the other guys, is this Schiller and then also a guy, a fund manager over here, what you brought out was something they didn't bring out. That, you know, it took a QE1, 2, 3 twist, a lot of bond buying, a lot of junk going on, and they pull this again, and the dollar is going to get hit. Please explain.
Well, first of all, you know, I predicted a lot more than just the stock market going down back then. I mean, I predicted the financial crisis, but more importantly, I predicted what the government would do as a result of the financial crisis and what the consequences of that would be, because that's where we're headed. You know, the real crash that I wrote about, you know, in my most recent book is still coming. You see, what happened was the Federal Reserve inflated a bubble in the 1990s under Alan Greenspan, and that bubble popped in 2001, and then Greenspan reached back into the same bag of tricks. And he had to cut interest rates even more. He had to go down to 1%, and he left them there for over a year and normalized them very slowly. But he did get rates back up above 5%. But in the interim years, he inflated a massive housing bubble, along with reflating the stock market bubble. And when that popped, we ushered in the 08 financial crisis, which would have been a lot deeper, and the stock market's decline far more substantial, again, had the Fed not intervened, just like it did last time. And so they inflated a much bigger bubble. So this is the third gigantic bubble that the Fed has inflated. And when this one pops, it's not going to be the third, you know, the third time's the charm. It's going to be three strikes, you're out, because I think that this bubble is too big to pop. I think it's the mother of all bubbles. And when it bursts, there is not a bigger one that the Fed is going to be able to inflate to mask these problems. I mean, meaning that we can't kick the can down the road anymore. We're gone. We're going to have to deal with these problems. And I think the problem that we're going to be confronted with is going to be much worse than a financial crisis. It is going to be a dollar crisis, and it is going to be a sovereign debt crisis, where the bonds that people are worried about are not some subprime mortgage that some guy, you know, borrowed money to buy a house he couldn't afford. It's going to be the U.S. government that people are worried about, and the solvency of the government and the treasury bonds. Because if there's a dollar crisis and people are worried about the dollar, the only thing worse than owning a dollar today is owning the promise to be paid a dollar in the future. So if there's a dollar crisis, there is a bond crisis. And that is going to be profoundly more impactful on the U.S. economy, on the average American, than what happened in 2008.
You have a house in Puerto Rico, and this is not a, hopefully your house is still there.
Yeah, it's there.
Okay, you know, so you know all about the debt problem down there, $874 billion, they defaulted on the debt. And I wanted you to comment on this, that Donald Trump said, you know, we have to wipe that out, that $74 billion in debt. Are we going to have a carnival of default and inflation? Is that what you're, and not every bond's going to be liquefied and inflated. I mean, some people take it in the chops, right?
Well, when you borrow money that you can't repay, default is inevitable. The only question is the form of the default. Now, when Trump was talking about wiping out Puerto Rican debt, it was basically where Puerto Rico would just not repay the loans, where the bondholders were just not going to get their money back, literally, that Puerto Rico wasn't going to pay, they're going to default. And that has to happen. And, of course, Puerto Rico couldn't pay even before the hurricane. Now, after the hurricane, you know, it's even more impossible. But on a broader topic of wiping out debt, that is what is going to happen to all U.S. Treasury bonds. It's all going to get wiped out. But I don't think it's going to get wiped out the way Puerto Rican debt is. I don't think that we have the courage to default, to admit to our creditors that we don't have the money and we can't repay. I think we'll create all the money that we need. so that we can pretend to repay. But what we end up doing is wiping out the debt with inflation, meaning you get your money back, but you don't get your purchasing power back because your money loses its value. So the debt's going to get wiped out. It's only a question of how, and people have to protect themselves.
You were trying to, you said in the pre-interview, you said that, you know, I'm trying to get the piano player out of this party. I'm trying to get the waiters and the waitstaff, the little people. They're going to get creamed. Explain.
Well, you had asked me a question about how much debt we can have. You know, you were talking to my wife, and you said, hey, we got $20 trillion in debt. You know, why can't we go to $35 trillion? Why can't we go to $40 trillion? Why can't we just continue to increase the national debt? And what my point was, when you said, you asked me, you know, how high can the debt go? And I said, I don't know. You know, you don't know. It reminds me of the old adage about how many straws can you put on a camel's back. You don't know until you put that final straw that's one too many, and then you break his back. So, you know, can we go to $25 trillion? Maybe. But can we go to $30 trillion? We're not going to know. At some point, we're going to break the back of the camel with all this debt. And then we're going to find out how much debt we can pile on, and it's not going to be pretty, because then we're going to have a crisis. I mean, it's much better if you get a handle on the debt yourself instead of, you know, waiting for a market-driven event. But no politician is going to do that. Nobody wants to leave the party early. They want to stay there until the police come to break it up, right? And when the police come to break up the party, they take everybody, right, including that piano player, and the piano player is my client. I want to make sure that my guys are not playing the piano in that party when the cops come and raid it, because everybody is going to lose. Everybody's going to get wiped out who's been partying in the stock market, particularly in the bond market and the real estate market. The dollar is going to tank and purchasing power is going to get wiped out. So I want my clients to be out of harm's way. That's why I've been investing, and I continue to invest for people around the world in countries that I believe to be relative safe havens.
That's Peter Schiff. Now, he says everybody's going to get wiped out. No, not everybody. There's going to be people, including in this audience, who've gotten off the grid, who've liquefied and put themselves in a position to have no debt and are not out there on some stupid buying spree, but instead are holding on silver, gold, dollars, mixed currencies, and then start looking at how you can cooperate with other people to share the future, future creative events, and so you have assets for the future. That's just my thought. The full interview with Peter Schiff is on our website. So we're closing out here today on this program. I just want to mention that tonight will be the only showing in the United States, in any theater, a private screening for Deadly Deception. And I would like people in this audience who would like to be there and watch it, one of the most powerful documentaries, if not the hardest-hitting documentary I've ever done, to join me. It's at 7 p.m. in Manhattan. I'll give you the number for the box office. And if you're a limited-income person, I always purchase tickets and set them aside at a great discount, 30% off, so that they can also afford to come. Call 212-864-5400, 212-864-5400, 212-864-5400, and I look forward to seeing you there. For everyone else around the world, you'll be seeing this on a webinar and with speakers from all over the world, from New Zealand, from Australia, from Great Britain, from France, and myself and others in the United States in the middle of January. So you can watch it over your computer and have a webinar experience at the same time. That'll be in, so nobody has to not be able to see it. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. Stay tuned for Utrice Lee coming right now.